You've probably heard of the Winchester Mystery House, the sprawling San Jose Victorian mansion, which they say was built by gun heiress Sarah Winchester to atone for the many deaths of those killed with the weapons that made her fortune. There's even a new movie about the ghosts in the house out now. But how much of that story is true?
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters.
I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
Today we're going to talk with author Colin Dickey about his book, Ghostland. And thanks to Rachel Lee for being the first listener to suggest the book to us. Other listeners also suggested the book, and we tried to get Colin on in October, but couldn't get things scheduled. So here we are now, and there's this new movie in theaters about the Winchester House, which figures prominently in Dickey's book. I'd already learned some of the real story about that case from Karen's research in her book, Haunting America. But Dickey expands on that material in interesting ways. Ghosts mean different things to different people and exist in all cultures in different ways, from haunted brothels to haunted electronics to haunted toy stores. The Ghostland book tells of the dead and the living in a moving narrative which should please both skeptics and believers. So let's get to the interview.
Monster Talk.
So first of all, welcome to Monster Talk. Thanks for taking the time to join us.
Thanks for having me on.
I really enjoyed Ghostland, and unfortunately,
it's a very popular book.
Yeah, it is. Yeah,
and a number of our listeners, I think, had suggested the book too.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
It seems like a really nice overlap with our audience. I think they'll enjoy this. I think it's while we've talked about a lot of the topics on there, and Karen's done a lot of investigations directly pertinent to some of the stories you cover, it treats them in a very poetic way. I think it's nice. So, yeah. We'll continue to make compliments interspersed throughout the interview.
I'm not going to object. This is all going fine so far. No problems here.
Well, could we ask you for a little bit of an introduction? Could you tell us a bit about yourself?
Sure. My name is Colin Dickey. I grew up in San Jose, California. So I grew up near the Winchester Mystery House. Spent a lot of time living in L.A., sort of traipsing around the various haunted places in L.A. and whatnot. Spent some time in New York. Wrote a book in 2009, a nonfiction book about famous people's skulls that had been stolen out of the grave.
Wow.
And a book on weird Catholic saints. And then I ended up writing this book on ghosts. So, yeah, so that's kind of the trajectory in a nutshell.
Famous historic skullduggery, right?
right. Mozart, Beethoven, Goya, all those guys had their heads stolen after they were dead.
Wow.
Yeah. That's only parts of Beethoven's head, I should clarify.
Oh, only parts of his head were stolen?
Yeah. There are two about 4-inch long pieces of his skull that are currently in Northern California, about 30 minutes north of San Jose.
That's interesting.
Yeah. But anyways, yeah, that's not necessarily why I'm here, but it's a fun fact.
Yeah.
It's one to read next then.
Yeah. So we're here to talk, I guess, today about Ghostland, which came out in, I believe, 2016. And we had tried to talk to you, you know, around Halloween, but I imagine around Halloween you're overwhelmed with people wanting to talk to you.
Sure, yeah.
But every day's Halloween on Monster Talk, so. How did you come to write about ghosts? I mean, what led you to talk about that particular topic?
So I grew up near the Winchester Mystery House, which I always loved as a kid, and whenever people would come to visit, I'd always, you know, take them there. And I loved the story of, you know, this woman who was building a house that was supposed to never be finished, and it was this kind of labyrinth to keep ghosts at bay. you know, that ghosts that had been killed by the Winchester rifle. And I thought, wow, this is such an amazing story, and what a fascinating biography it would be to write a, you know, biography of Sarah Winchester. So actually, you know, about 2009, right after my first book came out, I sort of started doing research, thinking I could just sort of kind of write a quick biography of Sarah Winchester, and found out that much of the story, at least the story that you get on the tour, is not based in fact, and is somewhat of an invention. And I, you know, I went from being sort of, you know, disillusioned, sort of, to being kind of doubly intrigued. You know, the question was then, you know, not, you know, necessarily, you know, what is the true story, so much as, you know, why did this fable take on, you know, such a life that, you know, it, you know, has lasted for almost 100 years now, and it's influenced, you know, everybody from Walt Disney to Stephen King. And I just got really interested in why this house, why this mythology, and I started to broaden it from there, sort of just ask that question, you know, why do some houses, some hotels, some prisons get a reputation for being haunted and others don't? And why do some stories resonate with the public and other ones just get, you know, kind of tossed aside after a while? So that was kind of what led me to the book, and kind of broadening out, sort of starting with San Jose and then broadening out to more and more places around the country, kind of trying to explore different versions of that kind of, you know, creation of sort of American mythologies.
Can we talk about the Winchester House a bit? I think right now there's a movie in theaters that seems to be, I'm going to put air quotes, based on the Winchester House, but...
Yeah, considering
well, it's based on the tour.
The box office, it's not going to be in theaters for much longer, but yeah.
Yeah, but it seems like it's based on the folklore and not on any kind of reality, and maybe even fictionalized of that. As I don't want to say that's strictly fiction, but it does seem like there's not much to back up the legends around it.
No, I mean, it's a really bizarre thing. And yeah, and I saw the film the weekend it came out and reviewed it for the New Republic, and it's got like a 10% rating on Rotten Tomatoes. It's not quite as bad as you would be led to believe. It does, yeah, as you say, it does sort of take the story that you get on the tour and posit it as true. And even some of the other reviews I've seen that you know, I saw a piece in Vanity Fair that was like, you know, this is the actual story behind Sarah Winchester, and then they proceeded to get a bunch of details wrong too. So it's a fascinating sort of layer upon layer of, you know, almost like a game of telephone about this woman's life. And part of the thing that's really interesting / difficult is that we simply just don't have a lot of material from her. We don't have a lot of letters or diaries or firsthand accounts, you know, which is a little bit odd considering how wealthy she was. You know, historians will tell you most of the time the records that you have are of wealthy people because they tend to leave a lot of records and those things tend to get preserved. It's, you know, it's usually poor people who, you know, don't keep diaries, or, you know, that stuff gets thrown out after they die. So it's a bit unusual that we don't have more information from her, but what little we do have, we've got a couple letters in a Connecticut Historical Society and a couple other sort of things here and there, you know, overwhelmingly points to the fact that she was sane, that she was not, you know, undergoing a kind of endless period of pathological mourning, and she did, you know, we don't have any evidence that she was a spiritualist or anything like that. And so, we don't have definitive proof otherwise, but we have nothing to really support that mainstream story of her. And so, it becomes difficult to reconstruct an actual sort of piece about her life. But the film, yeah, it takes a lot of liberties. It runs with the kind of story that you get on the tour, and it kind of just becomes a kind of standard horror movie at some point.
So, there's a biography about Sarah Winchester, and I can't remember the author's last name. I think it's Sarah Ignatio or something.
So Mary Jo Ignoffo or something. I'm not exactly sure actually how to pronounce it, but it's IG.
That's a very good book that gives a very fair overview of Sarah Winchester's life and really does debunk a lot of the stories which are told on the tour. And the tour is very interesting. I'm sure a lot of our listeners have been on it before themselves, but it's told very robotically. The story hasn't changed for many years, and I've been on it several times myself. But can you tell us a little bit about some of the things that the current owners have done to maintain the myths about Sarah Winchester?
Yeah, I mean it's interesting, and you know, and I know the people who are, I've been in touch with the general manager, and you know, and I as much as I don't, you know, believe the story that they tell on the tour is factually correct, I'm hesitant to be too disparaging, because as one of the things I write about in the book is the Winchester House sits across from one of the most expensive malls, or at least when it was built, one of the most expensive malls ever built in America, and the real estate that the Winchester House is on is I don't know, very very worth a lot of money. So you know, so they're, even though it's on the historical register, you know, they have to find a way to keep people coming to it, given its high visibility and its high retail potential. And so you know, I think what they have done over the years is taken this house, which, you know, is a kind of architectural wonder, a kind of one-of-a-kind architectural landmark, and found ways for it to be relevant and interesting to successive generations. So, yeah, as you say, I mean, the tour focuses a lot on the fact that her husband and infant daughter both died, and that she then went into a sort of period of pathological mourning, and attended a medium session with a spiritualist named Adam Koons, who told her that her house was being, or that her family was being haunted by anyone who's ever been killed by a Winchester rifle. You know, none of that, you know, of course we have any verification of, and one of the things that Mary Jo Ignoffo points out in her book, which I thought was a really sort of elegant line of reasoning, is that spiritualism is fundamentally a communal effort. It's you don't do it by yourself, or certainly you didn't in the 1880s. You know, it was something you did with a group of people, and the fact that there was an incredibly vibrant and well-documented spiritualist community in San Jose, California at the time. And, you know, Sarah Winchester's name never, you know, appears on any of those, you know, news reports is a pretty strong indication. And what you see in the film where she's sort of having these one-on-one seances where it's just sort of her alone in a room is certainly not in keeping with spiritualism as a historical development. So I completely lost track of whatever your original question was. I was just kind of rambling. So. Sorry.
No, I was. No worries. I was thinking in terms of some of the oddities in the house, like the windows and floors, and the motif of number 13 everywhere, and that these weren't placed there by Sarah Winchester. These were placed there by the Brown family that currently owned them.
Yeah. Well, so I mean, certainly, yeah. Some of that, I think, is, you know, there were genuine, you know, Tiffany glass with, you know, 13 precious gems embedded in them, and other things like that. But I think once you start going around the house looking for things that add up to 13, I mean, you could do that in your own house and find, you know, half a dozen rooms with 13 nails or 13 lights or 13 books on a shelf or something like, you know, I mean, you'll find it anywhere. And in the house, in the ballroom, there's this beautiful silver chandelier that has 12 candles, and then there is this 13th candle kind of welded onto the base in a kind of awkward, jaunty angle.
Thank you for pointing this one out. That's always bugged me, that one.
Yeah, and the tour operators are like, well, she had to have 13 candles. And again, I think Mary Jo Ignoffo is quite right in suggesting, A, that this was added later, and B,
yes,
Sarah Winchester was wealthy enough that if she wanted a chandelier with 13 candles, she would have had one custom made. You know, she wouldn't have had to tack on an extra one, you know, like a DIYer at the end there. So,
yeah.
That's pretty funny. The one that struck me was the way, by word of mouth, the legend, there's stairways that lead to nowhere, like stairways, plural, And then
right.
apparently there's just the one, and that there's probably a good explanation.
Pretty much just the one, yeah. And again, I mean, I think that's kind of a bummer, because I think a lot of people are kind of let down on the tour because they are expecting this kind of M.C. Escher-esque kind of labyrinth. And, you know, there's the one stairway that sort of ends in a wall that, you know, she was either going to kind of build something and forgot about it, or, you know, architectural plans change or something like that. You know, there's a couple of other, there's a closet where it seems pretty clear they just removed the floor because it opens up onto the kitchen below. So there are things like that where, you know, you could see them just sort of making kind of minor modifications so that they could play it off as this kind of labyrinthine house. But I think, again, I mean, for me as a, you know, just as somebody who's you know, taken a dozen or so tours in that place, I mean, I feel like the house is cool enough as it is, just standing on its own. I mean, this is actually the thing that I quite like about the Winchester movie, is as silly as a horror movie as it is, you know, they had access to the house and they shot within the house. And so, you know, you get these really great tracking shots of the house that, you know, you're never going to see on a tour. You know, you're never going to be able to sort of hover over like you're in a drone or something. And it really kind of brings the house alive just through the cinematography in a way that I like.
Would you say that was worth the price of admission? I'll go read your review. We'll put a link to your review in the show notes.
Yeah, as I said, maybe catch it on Netflix. I don't know. Maybe it's not worth the price of, you know, $15 or whatever. But you know, there are worse films out there. You know, I'll say that.
So. It's cheaper than going to the Winchester Mystery House. That's for sure.
That is also true.
Wow.
Yeah, 'cause the tour is not cheap.
No.
I only been out there once, and I just couldn't make it work with my time schedule, but I really wanted to go visit it.
You'll have to do that.
Yeah, the thing to do if you really want to weird it up is to take the tour at the Winchester Mystery House, and then while you're still buzzing from the endorphins, drive over the 5 minutes to the Rosicrucian Museum, which is also in San Jose and is... if you're not familiar, it is an Egyptian temple in the middle of the suburbs. It is built to look exactly like an ancient Egyptian tomb, and it's filled with all these Egyptian artifacts. And it's just sitting there, surrounded on all sides by these little unassuming suburban tract homes. And it's a totally bizarre place. You can do both of them in one day and really get your fill of all the weirdness that San Jose has to offer.
Nice.
Lots of weird stuff in San Jose.
While reading your book, I think this site in particular and some of the others figure into this concept of dark tourism. While you were doing your research, did you notice any trends around this sort of rise of dark tourism?
Yeah, I mean, as you hinted at, I mean, I was really interested in the way in which different historical sites have really tried to keep themselves relevant. And so... So the Merchant's House Museum in Manhattan is another place that, you know, has been open to the public as a sort of historical tour since I think the 30s, but only recently has it started really embracing, you know, the stories of it being haunted and sort of bringing in, you know, ghost tours and things of that nature. And again, I think part of that is because real estate in Manhattan is really valuable, and if you want to keep a historical site open, you've got to find ways to, you know, pay the bills and whatnot. But I also think that it is a sort of evolution over time into people figuring out that this kind of tourism is a way of interacting with the past that, you know, I think more and more people are kind of open to and receptive to. I mean, it's often frustratingly a kind of distortion of the past, but it's still, you know, I still think that people have that genuine desire to sort of interact with the past in a kind of different way. And so, you know, for the book, I went to a bunch of different places, you know, Salem, Massachusetts, New Orleans. I took a lot of ghost tours, and some of them were really fantastic, and some of them were pretty unbearably hokey. But you see this kind of almost kind of ad hoc strategy from place to place, where people are sort of experimenting with, you know, how does the public sort of like see this building, and how do they, what kind of stories will resonate with the public, and what do they hope to get out of, you know, 2 hours walking through an old house? And I think that's a really kind of fascinating story, particularly because it changes so much from place to place.
So what are some of the places that you went to in New Orleans? Because it's very rich in folklore and stories. And I'm just curious about which places you went to and what you found.
Yeah, I mean, New Orleans is so filled, and an early problem I had was sort of trying to figure out how to keep it all narrowed down. One of the places that, you know, is most famous and is very much not open to the public is the LaLaurie Mansion, which got sort of roped into a season of American Horror Story. This woman who supposedly, kept these slaves that she tortured and sort of did horrible and unethical medical experiments on. After she and her husband were sort of driven out of town, it kind of, you know, changed hands over the years. It was a tenement slum for a while, and that's when, you know, these young kids started getting the idea that they could charge people a nickel to see ghosts in the attic, and, you know, that involved, you know, one of their friends dragging chains around the attic and making spooky noises. It was, for a time, it was a boarding school, or not a boarding school, but a public school that was sort of involved in a race riot. Over the years, it fell into sort of various private hands. It was owned by Nicolas Cage, the actor, who lost it in foreclosure, and now it's owned by, from what I was told, it's owned by somebody from Texas who is not there very much of the time, and so mostly it just sort of sits empty, and it's the ghost hunters I talked to, all of them are salivating to get inside of it, but none of them could. So I did a lot of research and a lot of time with the LaLaurie Mansion, and then the other place kind of on the other end of the spectrum that I spent time with was Charcoal's Burgers, which is a high-end burger joint in the Magazine District. And you can get all manner of bison and alligator and turkey burgers with all sorts of toppings and local craft beer. And it's haunted by a woman who was killed during Hurricane Katrina. She was hit by a drunk driver, and her body was left out in the street for a couple days, just because things were so out of control during Hurricane Katrina, and the emergency services were just completely non-functioning. And so Charcoal's Burgers has over the years been thought to have been haunted by this woman's ghost. And so I tried to kind of pair those two buildings as kind of two different ways that New Orleans has responded to its own history, particularly its own tragedies over the years, through telling these stories of haunted places. And I guess had I more time, I could have done a whole book on New Orleans, because there's so many fascinating supposedly haunted places in that town.
Is your next book?
I guess so, yeah. If anybody gives me any more money to write another one of these, I've got a whole other slew of places I'd like to go, but as of yet, nobody has come forward. So
it's very interesting to hear about newer ghosts, because we just often associate with New Orleans just the older stories and are going back hundreds of years. So it's interesting to hear that new stories are being created all the time there.
Yeah, exactly. And I think New Orleans is a great example of a place that, because they are, as a city, kind of, okay with that part of their legacy, this kind of, haunted aspect. And obviously, they embrace it for the tourists. But because it's kind of more of an open part of their culture, it's commonplace to then fold in kind of more recent historical traumas and tragedies into that same narrative. And so, even more recent things like Katrina and other sort of fresher wounds are easily folded into a longer history of New Orleans and its ghosts.
I thought it was really interesting, because the whole book, you talk about a lot of different geographical places and a lot of ghost stories, and you talk about what the evidence is that supports it and what seems to be legend, but you clearly are not going around just to debunk the ghost stories, and it's not exactly like you're precisely celebrating them. I found it incredibly compelling. It's really a really good book. Can you, What drove you to take this particular angle on these stories?
Yeah, I mean, I'm enough of a just sort of naturally curious person that I want to know the real story. Like, that's just who I am. And so when I would hear these stories and I would think, that's a really crazy story, I would immediately want to know, you know, is it true? You know, I mean, you know, like the Lemp Mansion in St. Louis, Missouri, I mean, you know, that's a pretty crazy story, and it's one that is factually accurate. So fine, you know, I mean, it is the story of this pretty wealthy family who, you know, over the space of a couple decades, multiple members of the family all committed suicide for different reasons and at different times, and so the house is supposedly haunted by, you know, this family that were all kind of driven to suicide. And you know, and so it's, so that is, you know, unlike the Sarah Winchester story, that actually happened. And you know, so part of me is just sort of fascinated with, you know, what is the true story? What do we know about these places? And then beyond that, I think I was just really curious as to why we tell some stories and we don't tell others. You know, why does this story, you know, I mean, there are lots of stories in which, you know, multiple members of a family have committed suicide, and it's sort of horrible and tragic and, you know, something I think we want to prevent. But here's one case in which it's sort of oddly celebrated, or at least not celebrated, it sort of drives the history of this house. And I was, you know, what, you know, why, you know, is it because these people were wealthy? Is it because, you know, what is it about these people that has taken this sort of family tragedy and blown it up into, you know, I guess you could say a tourist attraction. And so, you know, and then I was sort of equally interested. I mean, you know, I went to Richmond, Virginia, you know, which is one of the most haunted cities in America. And I was, you know, just gathering up all the various ghost stories about, you know, downtown Richmond, just kind of, you know, figuring out what was there and what, trying to make sense of what they all meant. And it just sort of suddenly struck me at some point that every story that I was reading involved white people. And I thought, you know, this is the heart of the Confederacy. This is the, you know, the second largest slave trading market where, you know, untold, you know, enslaved Americans were brutally beaten and died. And how come there aren't any ghost stories about these people? You know, so a lot of it, I mean, there was a couple of guiding principles for the book, but in a lot of cases, I would just kind of be investigating a particular location and kind of let the specificities of that location and the stories that I was reading kind of suggest to me, you know, the research method, as it were, sort of to try and figure out, you know, exactly what was going on here and what made it different or special than other places.
You mentioned the most haunted city, or one of the most haunted cities in America. Did you find, as I've usually found, that most cities claim to be the most haunted in America?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, sure. Yeah. I mean, New Orleans will claim it. Salem, Massachusetts will claim it. Yeah, Richmond will claim it. Savannah, Georgia claims it. Yeah, so it's pretty common. And again, it's because I think at some point people realize that there is a tourist market to be made. And so, you know, it gets folded in just like everything else in a city's sort of boosterism.
Yeah, we don't have a good spiritual census to really get the hard numbers, do we?
Right, exactly. Yeah, no, exactly. And what would qualify? And yeah. So
you mentioned Salem. What did you find there?
Yeah, I mean, Salem is bizarre. Have either of you been up that way?
Not
Unfortunately,
yet.
I haven't. I've always wanted to go there, but
Me too.
I haven't made it.
I want to do this sort of combination H.P. Lovecraft witchcraft tour at some point in my life.
Yeah, well, so Salem, again, I mean, it was, you know, home to this, you know, historical injustice, and then, you know, kind of moved on with its life. And then in the 19th century became, for a time, the wealthiest city in the country because they had a really strong shipping industry and were importing and exporting a lot of cotton and other things. And so, and then in the 20th century, it started to sort of go back to this kind of legacy of the Salem witch trials, and it decided to sort of capitalize on this in this very weird way. And so, the police cars all have a witch and a broom on the door, and the town logo, I think, is a witch and a broom, and there are all sorts of these, you know, hokey, you know, crystals and incense shops all around the town, and you can get your fortune read, and you know, lots of just sort of kind of hokey new age tourism stuff, and then some very heartfelt and serious commemorations of these people who were innocently executed, and it's very bizarre. It was very hard for me to kind of balance those kind of competing emotional registers. You know, I mean, it was very, you get kind of quickly annoyed by the statue of Samantha from the show Bewitched, you know, and then a block over, you're faced with the legacy of these men and women who were killed, and the enormity of the weight that is sort of bearing down on you. And so we found it to be a very fascinating, strange place to visit. And also, it's just a lovely little New England town with a great museum. And, you know, it's an odd but nice place. So
I guess they've recast their image.
Yeah. And and they seem to be really sort of, you know, I mean, what I think I finally sort of decided about Salem is that it's a place in which we have an awareness of history, but very little sense or engagement with what that history actually means. You know, we throw, I mean, especially, you know, now, I mean, you see the phrase witch hunt being thrown around almost on a daily basis. And so we, you know, as Americans have a really quite cotton to the idea of witch hunts and whatnot, and yet we also sort of strangely kind of celebrate the witches of Salem as though they might have actually had supernatural powers. You sort of see this, you know, in everything from Longfellow's poems about the Salem witch trials to the aforementioned Bewitched. You know, I mean, we sort of want to believe that witches actually are supernatural. It's just very confusing. It's a very bizarre muddle of responses to this historical incident, and you know, different people sort of have a different reaction to it. And I, you know, it was an interesting sort of cognitive experiment to try and sort of parse all these different ways in which the term witch was being used in and around the town of Salem.
Because it reminded me of the sort of way that Disney has taken like the grim fairy tales and turned them into these sort of sweet and friendly family movies. But if you go back and read a lot of the grim fairy tales, they're brutal and horrific. And it's like we've sort of sanded off all the rough edges and reinterpreted it to be something completely different from what the original source material was.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And again, I mean, I think that is just sort of part of what we do as you know, humans. I mean, it's sort of like how we respond to history is by sort of evolving things. And sure, I mean, who doesn't like a Cinderella story where they chop off their toes to try and jam them into the glass slipper, or however the original is? I mean, you know, I love it. But yeah, I guess that's not gonna fly at the multiplex this weekend. And so, you know, things sort of change over time. And you know, is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? I mean, I grew up during a time when some of the weirdest kids movies ever made were just being sort of released without any sense of whether or not they were any good or not. And they were all pretty traumatizing, but I, you know, I loved them, and they really sort of sharpened my imagination in a way that, you know, The Little Mermaid or The Lion King wouldn't have done in the same way. So, you know, I mean, I like the weird stuff, but I get that it sort of has to change over time, and I get that people will take different things out of the history that they want. I mean, that's just sort of the nature of the changing sort of generations.
I was just going to comment that it was probably something you found with most of these places that you investigated, that kind of bit of sweetness of that blend of tourism and humor about the place, and the tackiness, and blended in with the history and the seriousness about what truly went on in that place.
Yeah, it is. You're right. It's, I mean, it was most acute in Salem, but you find it everywhere. You find this kind of mixture of, you know, here's a horrible tragedy in which somebody was brutally murdered, And also, here's a fun T-shirt that you can get about said brutal murder. And it's odd. It's you know, one of the places that I went to was Portland, Oregon, and there's a park where there's supposedly the ghost of this woman who was murdered, and kids go up all the time to have these little seances and, you know, try and commune with her. But she was murdered in 1949, and her younger sister is still alive. You know, and I interviewed her younger sister, and you're talking to this woman about, you know, her personal tragedy, about you know, she recounted to me, I don't think I put this in the book, but she recounted to me when her sister's murderer finally got the chair, and, you know, and her mother talking about how, you know, now he's not going to harm anybody else, and, you know, her mother breaking down and crying, and now, you know, this woman who is in her, I guess she's probably in her 70s or 80s, you know, she, you know, crying on the phone with me, and you get the sense, like, this is not necessarily a joke for people, especially with these newer stories. And so, you know, with the book, I really tried to kind of walk that line. Like, I didn't want to be a complete killjoy, because I get that excitement and the frisson of being in a strange place in a, you know, dark house in the middle of the night. I get it, and it is a lot of fun, but I also, you know, wanted to be sort of aware of how we tell these stories and what it means to tell these stories as pure entertainment without any sort of regard for the victims.
Yeah, and you talk a lot about the real horror stories are often, like, completely hidden by these ghost stories. And this is a good example, and then some of the slave stories. Do you think there's a relationship there? Do you think that the ghostly stories are consciously being crafted to hide this? Is it more of an organic thing? Or what do you think is going on there?
Yeah, I don't think it's conscious so much as I think you're right, a sort of organic thing. I mean, you do find when you start, you know, kind of making taxonomies of these stories, you find the same stories from place to place. You know, I mean, they become generic after a while. There are a lot of places where, you know, it's clear that a given house is a little creepy or a little bit odd. But nobody really knows much about the house, so they just kind of throw in a kind of generic ghost story. Oh, so-and-so was killed here, whatever, and then they kind of make up a story to go with the oddity of the place. And, you know, I found that a lot, and I, you know, and you do, after a while, you start to see that, you know, some stories are really popular in terms of generating ghost tales, and some are not nearly as popular, you know. So, you know, violence towards women tends to be a thing that you see in, you know, ghost story after ghost story, and, you know, what do you make of that? You know, I mean, is that a lot of, you know, consumers of ghost lores are, you know, actually women, and the way that women sort of tend to respond to, you know, novels like Gone Girl and, you know, like sort of, you know, murder mysteries or what, you know, and, you know, as you mentioned, I mean, you know, stories about slaves are not as nearly prevalent as stories about slave owners or Confederate soldiers. You know, is that because white Americans don't really want to deal with that legacy? They don't want to face it head on. You know, I mean, it's kind of hard sometimes to make a hard and fast ruling, but you do see a lot of similarities that suggest kind of broad trends in how we use ghost stories both to kind of approach history while also kind of keeping it at arm's length.
Well, I, the way you end the book, you talked a little bit about digital hauntings, about Tom West's house with the weird Internet of Things. And it reminded me of, I've had some friends die over the past year or so, and Facebook has become haunted. Like, I don't believe in ghosts, but I find myself devastated when these sort of digital artifacts pop up out of nowhere, suggesting, "Hey, you haven't talked to this person in a while. Why don't you say hello?" Because they're dead, you know.
And right.
You know, it's their birthday. You want to say happy birthday? I would love to, but they're dead. And it's just, it's devastating. And I wish I could stop it, but
it's so bizarre. It's, you know, I mean, the way that Facebook and other social media sites work is, you know, of course, they want you, engaged. They want you on the site. They want you looking at ads all the time. And the, like the worst thing that can happen, I mean, I've kind of stopped using Facebook, and so I'm getting emails all the time from Facebook basically saying, you know, come back to the site, check out what your friend just posted, you know, because they're petrified with the idea that you would stop interacting with them, but they have no frame of reference if you've stopped interacting with them because you hate Facebook or because you are no longer among the living, you know, and it's sort of this very odd sort of conflating of two entirely different states of reality. And so when you know, I'm off the site, I'm sure Facebook is telling my friends to, you know, wish me happy birthday and all that crap, and it'll continue after, you know, after I'm gone. Well, hopefully I'll outlast Facebook, but knock on wood. So it's very odd that we've built these social media sites and these algorithms that are completely unable to understand death. And I think that's a really fascinating yet frustrating problem. And, you know, it'll evolve over time. But in the meantime, it does become quite awful for people who, you know, when you're still mourning somebody's loss, to have this algorithm sort of throw them sort of their memory kind of unexpectedly back up at you just because the algorithm is panicked for some weird reason.
Yeah, so. It reminded me of Ray Bradbury's story, There Will Come Soft Rains. It's like it's come true in a lot of ways.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. When I first started doing that chapter, I mean, that Ray Bradbury story suggested itself immediately. It's just this idea of, like, you know, Facebook is like the house that just keeps on serving tea and putting out breakfast and reciting the temperature, and we'll continue to do that even after nobody's using it anymore.
Yeah, it's weirdly prescient.
Yeah.
So on your travels, I'm curious, did you encounter a lot of ghost hunters and people who were legend tripping, so going to replicate and experience hauntings?
I tried to find those folks wherever I could, just because I'm totally fascinated by them, and I'm fascinated by so many of them have completely different reasons for doing this. I mean, you know, I talked to some people for whom they consider themselves, you know, hard scientists who are trying to prove the existence of wormholes. I talked to other guys for whom ghost hunting was clearly these, like, two guys, this was their way to have fun away from their wives on the weekend, and so they would go out and hunt ghosts, and then they go to a strip club. You know, like, it's sort of like everybody seemed to have a kind of different reason for doing that, and so it's such a bizarre subculture. I did kind of run afoul of some rival factions in the Los Angeles ghost hunting community, and got accused of being a mole trying to undermine some sort of ghost hunting group. So after that happened, I kind of had to be a little bit more circumspect about how far I got involved with these folks. But whenever I would go to a place, in addition to doing whatever history I could, I would, you know, do a Google search and figure out who was giving tours, what were the local paranormal communities, who was available, and who, you know, who would have coffee with me and talk to me about, you know, what they did and why they did it.
So you also talked a little bit about the idea of when do we really die? And I love the sort of that African concept about there's the death that you have when you stop being alive, and then a different death when everyone who knew you's gone.
Right.
But it seems like that's something you must be thinking about a lot based on your bio. So what is your interest in this idea of death? I mean, what is the order of the good death? Tell me more about that.
Yeah, well, I mean, so the order of the good death was actually founded by my friend Caitlin Doughty, D-O-U-G-H-T-Y, who is an actual licensed mortician and also a fabulous writer and internet personality. And her mission is to really kind of overturn a lot of the assumptions that the funeral industry sort of makes on our behalf, and sort of encourage people to sort of reclaim death and dying and burial rites and mourning for ourselves and sort of make it meaningful, and whether or not that means, you know, a green burial or, you know, a sort of burial on your own property. You know, I mean, she wants to kind of open up the possibilities so that, you know, I think that, you know, too often when somebody dies, you're already emotional, you're overwhelmed, you don't know what the proper protocol is, and then, you know, a funeral director shows up, says, we'll take care of it all, and then hand you a bill for $15,000 or whatever, and, you know, and so I think she's trying to sort of push back against that. So that's the order of the good death, and so, you know, that's what they do, and they put together something called Death Salon, which deals with a lot of these issues annually, that all of your listeners should go and learn more about. I mean, for me, I ever since I was a kid, I've been completely terrified of dying, and I found that the one thing that makes death easier for me to understand and not fear is to just spend all my time writing and researching about it. And so I have, you know, in many ways, this has just become a way for me to sort of, again, kind of explore kind of how we face death, how we process it, how we mourn, how mourning changes over time. You know, I mean, why did the Victorians have these elaborate rituals of mourning? And, you know, why does Mexican culture have this fabulously colorful Day of the Dead sort of tradition? And, you know, how do these things sort of change in time and place? And I just remain perpetually fascinated by this. And I think the exploration of ghosts is yet one more avenue, because, you know, I mean, you know, as you say, with Facebook and whatnot, I mean, this is, ghosts are another way in which we mourn and another way in which we process the dead. And, you know, the amount of people who have told me stories about, you know, seeing the ghost of a loved one and then finding a way to make peace with them and then having that ghost sort of, you know, disappear. It's sort of, whether or not you believe in the paranormal or you think that's all psychology, it kind of doesn't matter, that these are both kind of ways of thinking about grief and processing the time after a loved one's gone.
Oh, I just realized that we have actually talked to another member of the order, Dr. Paul Kudineris.
Oh, yeah, Paul Kudineris, yeah.
Yeah, he came and talked about demon-possessed cats, and we had, we had a lot of cat puns, yeah.
Yeah, he's pretty fantastic, yeah. Yeah, so I will never be able to top his charisma or stage presence, and so you're getting definitely second tier order of the good death stuff today.
you're doing fine.
Yeah.
So over the course of the entire book, you talk about ghosts and hauntings from ancient Rome to modern times. Where do you think ghost stories will go next? Have you given any thought to what's the future of hauntings?
You know, I think we've hit on it already. I mean, I think the way in which you know, the digital landscape is going to become the commons of the future, right? I mean, ghosts used to, you know, they used to haunt the town square. They used to haunt, you know, the local bar. They used to haunt the local cemetery. And now, you know, we're congregating, you know, on Facebook, on Instagram, on Twitter. And more and more, I think, we're going to find ghosts following us there. And so I think in many ways the future is how these algorithms, how these social media sites, and how these other sort of electronic forms of communication will process our relationship to the dead. So I think that's going to be really fascinating, and I have no idea what it's going to look like.
So another place I haven't been to, the Mustang Ranch, and you talk about this in your book. Can you tell us a little bit about the hauntings associated with that? I didn't know it was meant to be haunted by who or what.
Yeah, I mean, I was actually sent there by a men's magazine. I guess in Britain we would say a lads magazine, because it's not quite, wasn't quite pornographic per se. But I was sent there to profile the owner, and the profile got canned. But I spent 2 days with these women who worked there and the management. And just as a side note, the madam mentioned in passing that the Mustang Ranch was incredibly haunted. And so I kind of had some time to kill. So I just started plugging people with questions about the ghosts in the Mustang Ranch. And, it's haunted, most people would say by, Oscar Ben. Oh, I've got a blank on his last name. He was a boxer. He was an actual professional boxer who was Bonavita. That's right. So he supposedly haunts the parking lot, but of course the Mustang Ranch has been literally picked up and moved to its current location. It was somewhere else originally. So the odd thing is that he's managed to follow the house to its new parking lot, and he haunts that new parking lot. You know, what I was really interested when I was talking to the women who work at the Mustang Ranch is, you know, to a person, they all described just what an emotionally taxing job it is. I mean, these women, you know, in addition to all their other talents and requirements, basically are working as unlicensed therapists because so much of their work is emotional. And it's just emotionally exhausting for a lot of them, you know, completely regardless of the physical requirements of the job. And so I was really interested, I guess, in a community of that we don't necessarily think of as a sort of high emotional stress environment, but that's exactly what it is, and how, you know, some of the women there have used those ghost stories, as a way maybe to kind of process or manage a little bit of that stress. I mean, if you're under a lot of anxiety and you know, maybe see some flashing lights out of the corner of your eye or something like that, it's maybe a little easier to believe that you're sort of surrounded by the paranormal, as it makes it maybe a little easier to sort of process some of your own internal stress or something like that. I don't know. I get into it more in the book, but I was really fascinated with how that particular community, which seemed quite singular, you know, quite different from, you know, any other employment that one might have in the country, would have a kind of different relationship to the paranormal than the rest of us.
That's different, a haunted parking lot.
Yeah, exactly.
but it was a very sensitive chapter. I thought you did a good job. I mean, the book is very moving and very poetic, and you have an enviable handle on prose, you bastard.
He's not jealous
at all. We're back to the compliment part. I like the part of the podcast.
Backhanded ones. Yeah.
It was really good. I really liked it. So I unreservedly recommend it to our listeners. So I think that they'll really like it too. We do try to finish up our interviews with this sort of common question, at least for the first time people come on. So that's, what's your favorite monster?
Right. So, I was thinking about this, and a monster I quite like is the Japanese no-face ghost.
Oh, good one.
Which your listeners might know from the Miyazaki movie Spirited Away, but this is a sort of common ghost, and actually, while it's common in Japan, you don't find it outside of Japan, except that I found it in Hawaii, and if I had had just like an extra couple of weeks and, you know, a couple hundred bucks to fly to Hawaii, I would have put this in the book. But there was a drive-in movie theater in Honolulu where you would go into the women's bathroom and there would be this woman with long black hair at the sink washing her hands. And when you went up close to her, she would turn to you and you would realize that she would have no face, that, you know, just it would just be sort of smooth skin like an egg. You know, instead of any facial features. And that's a common Japanese ghost. And what I like about them is that they, for the most part, are not out to harm you. They're not out to make your life miserable. They're basically, they're like pranksters because they sort of appear, they freak you out, and then they're gone. You know, and that seems to be the extent of their malevolence, is just to sort of kind of freak you out a little bit and then split. So, that seems like a kind of nice kind of monster. So I'll go with that.
I like it.
I'm just left wondering why women's bathrooms are always haunted.
Right. In Las Vegas, I was looking at haunted casinos, always the women's bathroom, always haunted.
Yeah.
It's so that you never have to go alone, because I know that's...
They have it, but they're often haunted by men. That's the problem.
That's correct.
Right. Or it's men who just have no concept of what could possibly go on in a woman's bathroom, so just assume that it's haunted.
Yeah, I don't know. That's I never really thought about it. I is it really? I mean, I know you guys are like serious, but is it actually?
It's a thing, and I can't remember it now for the show notes. But there's some TV show where they actually do cover, or it could be a blog maybe, and they cover women's bathrooms being haunted because it's a stereotype. It's a thing. I've found it a lot too. Everywhere I've gone to, the women's bathroom's always haunted.
Interesting.
Allegedly.
Allegedly. I tried to look into it. My research stalled.
Yeah. Oh, it's time to go.
Fine. Okay. Colin, thank you so much for taking time to talk to us.
Thank you. That was fascinating.
Thank you for having me on.
It's really a good book. Do you want to talk about what you're working on now or what your most recent book is?
So the book I'm working on now is on conspiracy theories, and along with UFOs and cryptids like Bigfoot and the Loch Ness Monster. So it's sort of similar in vein, sort of taking another thing that we don't take all that seriously and kind of trying to figure out kind of what is behind it all. So it'll deal a lot with the Illuminati and the Freemasons and UFOs and Area 51 and Bigfoot and the Federal Reserve and anything you could possibly want is going to get crammed in there. So that's what I'm working on now. So that's why my head is a little filled.
Well, that would be of no interest to our listeners.
That's right up our alley, all of that. We're going to have you back.
Yeah, let us know when that's done. Okay. That would be fantastic. And if you decide to include a chapter on people who love monsters but are skeptical of them, we'd love to talk to you about that. So, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, there will definitely be a lot on cryptids. So that, and particularly, I mean, I think what I'm interested in is the relationship between cryptids and what normally get called monsters and how that's changed over time. So I can come back and talk about that.
Yeah, that'd be fantastic. All right. Well, feel free to mine our archives if you want. We've got lots of episodes out there that may have links that would be pertinent to your research. So
that's right.
Okay. Thank you again. And we'll end this call here. And I really appreciate everybody making time today. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Colin.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. This was super fun.
Monster Talk.
You've been listening to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
You just heard an interview with author Colin Dickey about his book Ghostland. A link to the book and several other items that we talked about will be in the show notes at monstertalk.org. Monster Talk's an official podcast of Skeptic Magazine. The opinions expressed on this show are those of myself and my guests and may not represent the opinions or views of Skeptic Magazine or the Skeptic Society. If you'd like to know their views and opinions, you can just creep into the old sanitarium late at night, turn on your EMF detector, and once you've got that up and running, then you can fire up your digital copy of Skeptic from their online app on your smartphone or tablet device. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Monster Talk. Each episode, we strive to bring you the best in monster-related content with a focus on bringing scientific skepticism into the conversation. If you enjoy Monster Talk, we now have a variety of ways to support the show, all with convenient links at monstertalk.org/support. That's monstertalk.org/support. There we have links to our Patreon pages as well as a donation button. A great way to support the show is to buy us books from our Amazon Monster Talk wish list, which directly helps us with our research. We love used books very much, so don't feel compelled to buy new ones. And we love Kindle, and we can share our digital library with each other. Finally, without spending any money at all, you can support us by leaving a positive review at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Positive reviews help keep us visible in iTunes, which is a great way to help us find new listeners. And please, share our show on your favorite social media platforms. Monster Talk theme music is by Peach Stealing Monkeys. Thanks so very much for taking the time to listen to our show. We'll be right back.
Did you know that you can now subscribe to Skeptic Magazine digitally? Just grab our free Skeptic Magazine app, currently compatible with iOS, Android, PC, Mac, Kindle Fire, Kindle Fire HD, and BlackBerry Playbook. Head over to skeptic.com/magazine/app to find out more, and download more of your favorite Skeptic content.